your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We're going to share a lot of insights today, starting with the latest on how working out can make a big difference in fighting depression from Masters University, and about 15 other major articles on health and healing. Then we're going to go to a comment by a board-certified physician, public health scientist, talking about the dangers of communities allowing the G5 towers in their area. Plus 20,000 satellites are going to have these G5 towers, and that means that our entire country is going to be blanketed, and there's very serious health effects because of this. No one is talking about it. We will, and why we should protest it and not allow it. Then I'll take a couple questions from our talkback line in our voicemail. Number is 862-800-6805, 862-800-6805. And then in the second part of our program, I have a guest, and my guest is going to be speaking at in-depth. His name is Jerry Ashton, A-S-H-T-O-N, and we're going to talk about America's crisis in personal medical debt and debt forgiveness. Now, I was going to do today my universal health care program. However, I want Jerry to share his insights to see if there's anything I can contribute to the article from what he says, because he has a career in the credit and collection industry for over 40 years. He's the co-founder and executive director of RIP Medical Debt, which was inspired by the Rolling Jubilee Debt Forgiveness Initiative started by Occupy Wall Street. This is a nonprofit charitable organization that has abolished medical debt for tens of thousands of Americans. And back in 1985, after witnessing the way people had fallen into debt were treated, he founded CFO Advisors, which created debt-centric teams in several states to service up to $500 million in receivables annually. So that's something. In other words, they purchased the debt, and then they paid it off of people who couldn't afford it themselves. That's a very noble thing. He is the author of End Medical Debt, Curing America's $1 Trillion Annually. And Jerry's website, I'll give you a little later, it's ripmedicaldebt.org. Now, he's going to be the guest in the second part of our program. And something brand new today, in about 25 minutes, that I'll share with you. But we always start with the latest on health and healing. This is another article in the long series of articles showing the benefits of exercise. And we know this because of kinesthesiologists at McMaster's University have, for the first time, found that physical activity can help fight depression, especially as you get older, over the age of 50, by stimulating muscle-generated mood boosters. This is really neat. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal American Journal of Physiology, Cell Physiology, and reveals the underlying mechanisms which make us feel good when we exercise, persist into old age, and highlight the importance of staying active no matter what your age. A previous study demonstrated these mechanisms in healthy young adults. It was unknown whether the muscle deterioration which accompanies aging would preclude older adults from achieving similar exercise-induced benefits. So this could have enormous implications concerning the use of exercise as a treatment for depression. And we have millions of Americans who are depressed. And I'm going to be dealing with this in a brand new documentary that I'm doing about what happens in each stage of life where we're not prepared for that new stage. Other cultures do prepare people. That's why they value seniors and elders, wise men and women. We don't. We just think they're, you know, yesterday's newspaper, throw them away. Well, they're human beings. They deserve respect and love. And could you imagine what would happen if we took the 60 million of these individuals who are still active mentally and get them to donate time and energy to younger people who are in crisis? We're not doing that, but we should. But this shows that when you're physically active, let's say you're just walking fast, and the key is fast, brisk walking, not slow walking. Slow walking is junk exercise, doesn't help you. But when you're really trucking it, you're moving it, swinging those arms, you actually turn on genes within skeletal muscles, which can then influence the key metabolic pathway that ultimately promotes mood-enhancing chemicals such as serotonin within your brain. Now, muscle loss is a common problem in the elderly because they're not exercising. You need to exercise, and you need to make sure you're getting your branched-chain amino acids in order to get those muscles strong again and stimulate human growth hormone, and exercise helps you stimulate human growth hormone. So what we now know is this. When you're older, meaning over the age of 40, and you exercise on a regular basis, at least 120 minutes a week, I suggest 300 minutes a week, then you're stimulating messengers through chemicals in your skeleton that goes to the brain, stimulates serotonin, and hence you feel good. The endorphins, the feel-good hormone, and everyone in this audience who's ever done any form of exercise knows that when you're out there for an hour, hour and a half, biking, jogging, power walking, you feel good. And you should. And that's what this is about. All right? The feel-good hormones. So one way we can also challenge depression. Now, walnut consumption is able to help people with depression. University of California, Los Angeles. A new epidemiological study suggests consuming walnuts can be associated with a lower prevalence and frequency of depression. And that's important, by as much as 26% lower in depression for walnut consumers. So one more reason why we should be eating walnuts. We knew it was good for our heart. We knew it helped prevent heart disease. Now we can see walnuts help prevent depression as well. And that's because of the plant-based omega-3 alpha-linolenic acid, which is in more than any other nut in the walnut. So, good news, consume walnuts, help your heart, help your brain, help with depression. From Columbia University, could the omega-3 fatty acids help prevent miscarriage? And they found that the answer is yes. And this was published in the journal JCI Insight. And the compounds found in fish oil prevent pregnancy complications, including preterm birth and neonatal death and stillbirth, and this laboratory experiment. So if you are pregnant, take your omega-3 fatty acids each day. It can make a big difference. It's also anti-inflammatory. And if you're anti-inflammatory in your diet, you improve birth outcomes. So that's simple. Also, from South Korea University, they found that turmeric and mulberry, M-U-L-B-E-R-R-Y, can aid in arthritis. An independent study conducted on the two different things said it was found to turn off pain and inflammation, and also with edema. So alleviated with turmeric and mulberry together in this particular laboratory study. Now, I'm suggesting just getting mulberries. You buy dried mulberries and take, let's say, a quarter of a cup, and then take some curcumin. You can get 700 milligram curcumin, and you take two curcumin, that would be 1,400 milligrams, plus a quarter cup of mulberries, and see what that does for your pain. By the way, there's the botanical composite of this is flavonoids and stilbenoids, and in the curcumin. Very powerful, turning off pain. Also, we found that in a separate study, and this study was from Johns Hopkins University, that pain creams work about as well as placebos. Yeah. There is no scientifically significant evidence that expensive prescription pain creams and gels relieve soreness better than a placebo. And yet we know that many who suffer from chronic pain pay, $20 to thousands of dollars for a tube of prescription topical pain cream or gel. And this is according to the studies that were done by this group of scientists. Quote, our study of nearly 400 pain patients suggests that people who use these compounded creams and gels are being taken advantage of because the scientific evidence to support a benefit is not there. Okay. Now that's important, and I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But I want to also mention the University of Pittsburgh study. Increased vitamin B intake associated with a lower pancreatic cancer risk. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention. So researchers from the University of Pittsburgh have uncovered an association between an increase in the intake of your vitamin B6 and choline is C-H-O-L-I-N-E, and a lower risk of cancer of the pancreas. That's good news. Also, from Case Western University, blood cells could hold the master clock behind aging. This is brand new. Blood cells could really be important, according to new research. In a study published in Aging Cell, researchers found human blood cells have an intrinsic clock that remains steady even after transplant. The researchers say the clock control human aging may underlie cancer of the blood. And, quote, this study is related to the fountain of youth. We found young blood cells stay young in older people. There was no accelerated aging of young blood cells in an older human being. That's interesting. So maybe that's why you've been seeing how older people are getting transfusions to younger people's blood. Their inherent steadiness suggests blood cells could be the master clock of human aging, as they are not easily influenced by their environment. The study showed blood cells retain their epigenetic patterns in DNA methylation and chemical groups attached to DNA. So, just a new area for research. And also, for all of our American veterans, 123,000 of whom, unfortunately, have committed suicide since 1999. That's a huge number when you consider how many have served, and we're seeing all these deaths, and it's not an issue. There's no movement to show why these people are committing suicide. Is it the antipsychotic medication they're taking? What is it? We're not even interested in it. We should be. But from American University comes a study showing that meditation can help U.S. veterans manage chronic pain. That's important. So what we're going to do, we're going to take a break now. And we're going to come back and go right into the woman talking about, this doctor talking about G5. A break and then directly into that G5.
I'm an internal medicine physician. I've practiced medicine for 21 years, and my background is mostly academic, internal medicine, hospital-based, clinical research, and medical education. I am going to skip many of the things I wanted to say because I didn't realize it was only 5 minutes. Wireless radiation has biological effects, period. This is no longer a subject for debate when you look at PubMed and the peer-reviewed literature. These effects are seen in all life forms, plants, animals, insects, microbes. In humans, we have clear evidence of cancer now. There is no question. We have evidence of DNA damage, cardiomyopathy, which is the precursor of congestive heart failure. Neuropsychiatric effects. So 5G is not a conversation about whether or not these biological effects exist. They clearly do. 5G is a conversation about unsustainable healthcare expenditures. Why do I say this? We've been sitting on the evidence for EMR and chronic disease for decades. And now we are seeing all these epidemics appearing. So diabetes is the first epidemic. I think most of you know the statistics. They're very scary. 1 in 3 American children will become diabetic in their lifetime, and if they're Hispanic females, the number is 1 in 2. Okay. So what does this have to do with wireless radiation? Wireless radiation and other electromagnetic fields, such as magnetic fields and dirty electricity, have been clearly associated with elevated blood sugar and diabetes. That is what the peer-reviewed literature says. It is not opinion. The closer you live to a cell tower, the higher your blood glucose. That is based on hemoglobin A1C measurements. So the idea with small cells of putting the cells closer to people's homes and bedrooms, scientifically, is very dangerous. And from an economic perspective, it's dangerous. And you may not know this. I was shocked to find this out. But the way you create a model of diabetes in rats in the lab is by exposing them to 2.4 gigahertz. And this is not for long-term exposure. I don't have time to talk about the costs, but the huge problem with diabetes really is chronic kidney disease. End-stage renal disease, the worst complication of diabetes, leads to hemodialysis. Hemodialysis is an automatic qualification for Medicare. And if you don't qualify for Medicare, we still have to dialyze the patient. And the state ends up paying in many different instances. So renal failure is 1% of Medicare, but it takes up 7% of all Medicare expenditures. I don't have time to talk about this anymore, but once again, the other epidemics that clearly link from the science with electromagnetic radiation are related to mental health. And this is straight from PubMed. This isn't my opinion. This is science.
Dr. Goldberg, for those of us who aren't physicians, what is PubMed?
I'm sorry. It's just it's our National Library of Medicine. This is where you would go. This is just the peer-reviewed literature. So we have three epidemics that clearly, they're essentially one epidemic. We have deterioration of mental health in the United States. And if you look really at the science, what does it show? And these epidemics are our suicide epidemic, epidemics in violent, so shootings, and the opioid epidemic. And I don't have 5 minutes is not the time to talk about this. This is in the peer-reviewed literature. I have a file to submit for the record. But these are facts. These are things that have just been glossed over by the wireless industry. And I really don't have time to talk about them in 5 minutes. I wish I did. But we need to examine our epidemics in the context of our EMF exposures. What does that mean? That means that the CDC tracking these epidemics we need to start measuring how much radiation are people being exposed to, and before we roll out 5G. And this means there are 4 kinds of electromagnetic fields that we know are harmful to human health. So radio frequency radiation, magnetic fields, dirty electricity, and electric fields. Okay, our exposure, any given person, and all humans are affected by EMFs. Our given exposure has nothing to do with the research that my colleagues are going to cite with the National Toxicology Program. That is an assessment of the risk of one cell phone in the near field, okay? What is our exposure in a day? It's not one cell phone. It's cell phones, it's multiple wireless networks, it's smart meters, it's cell towers. It's this sandwich, and it all adds up. And this is a serious problem for occupational health, public safety, and personal safety. And I feel that it's irresponsible to be even talking about the Internet of Things and rolling out a new untested technology when we're not even measuring what are our current exposures from the current networks.
Okay, I just want you to know how bad it is, and I'll be doing more programs on it because it's a lot worse than what we have been led to believe. And that's important. Also, I want you to, I mentioned a little earlier when I was talking in our health segment that I would come back to an issue. And one of the issues I want to come back to is that there was a pharmaceutical company that just declared bankruptcy. And this Chicago-based pharmaceutical company made a lot of news 2 years ago when it showed that it was just profits scorching. And it took a $241 tube of an anti-pain cream, and it raised it to $9,561. That's a 3,900% increase. The cream called Aloquin, A-L-O-Q-U-I-N, said it was possibly effective in treating eczema and acne, but there was no proof of it. And yet they also took a cream called Alcortin and A and took it to $7,142. We're talking about a single tube. And so what I've done is I've now taken the top 10 drugs in the United States, and I've been able to find the actual manufacturer's generic 30-day cost, meaning if they weren't selling it to make a profit, here's how much it cost them. And some of these drugs that they're asking $200 and $300 for a 30-day supply or more cost them 10 to 20 cents, pennies. So now I'm doing a percentage of profit markup on each of the top 10 selling drugs in America. And they range from 3,600% up to 500,000%. Now, the new legislator, Cortez, and others are not aware of this. So that's why I'm holding off till Monday to send them this new universal health care, how we can actually save $1 trillion a year that goes back in the national treasury and not add any extra costs on at all. And I'll be sharing that with everyone, including all the statistics we have been able to put together. It's a very scholarly paper. I'm hopeful when I break this on Monday, and I will do it on Monday, that you'll all be paying attention and share it. Now we're going to go to some listener questions.
Good afternoon. This message is from Mr. Garinal. My name is Ezra, and I would like to know why my little puppy eats her stool. Every now and again I see her, she would eat her stool even though she's being fed properly. I try to give her the food that she's supposed to eat. I even give her probiotic. But I see her every now and again she's doing it. Can you please address this question? Thank you, and have a nice day.
Did you ever think maybe that's the reason she's doing it, is so she don't have to kiss you? Just a thought. Well, that's not uncommon. We see lawyers and politicians eating their own stool all the time. They just want to tell us it's cheesecake. The reality is the dogs will eat all forms of feces, especially if you have birds. They are notorious for scoffing it down. Why? No one knows. Is it because there's phosphorus in there and on an essential level they're taking it in? We don't know. When I was writing my book, Natural Pet Care, that was a question I wanted to ask, and I could not find the answer, so I do not have an answer for you. It's just that, just be aware that that when you let them lick your face, you're getting all kinds of bacteria and viruses or around your mouth. Loving them, you bet. I love my dogs. In fact, I set time aside every day for the dogs. But letting them lick me on the lips, no way. Because I take them for a run, and there's bird drop, they're gonna eat it. That's unfortunate. We'll take another call.
Hi, Gary, this is Derek from the Hyattsville, Maryland area. First of all, I want to say just how grateful I am for your good work that you've done for so many years, and you've helped a lot of people. My questions are, what is a good natural way to deal with cataracts? And also, what would be a good way to nurse someone to health or best way to approach them after they've had their thyroid removed?
Okay. With cataracts, you're dealing with an extreme chronic inflammation. Coffee, I would eliminate all coffee and caffeine. I would eliminate these high anabolic foods that create inflammation, any form of meat, sugar, artificial sweeteners, fried foods, deep-fried foods, barbecued foods. I would get rid of them because these contain the type of carbohydrate and the type of protein that when they combine through heavy heating, create massive glycation factors. And these glycation factors, and the hexamines, are terrible for the eyes. The eye is extremely vulnerable to oxidative stress. Even when people are running, even when people are exercising, you're creating oxidative stress, so you have to compensate. Vitamin C, quercetin, the carotenoids in particular. There's where your fruits, your colorful fruits and vegetables, like carrots and red peppers and yellow lemons, all that comes together, and those carotenoids help trap the free radicals. So the more antioxidants you're putting into the body, like vitamin E, that helps the eyes. And B-complex, that helps the eyes. And astaxanthin also. And then lutein and lycopene, watermelon, cherry tomatoes, raspberries, strawberries, the red fruits, and vegetables also protect the eyes. So that's what I would do. And also reading too close, being up towards a computer screen, very bad for the eyes. Now, when you remove a thyroid, the thyroid controls metabolism. I would approach it much like a person who has hypoglycemia and hypothyroidism, I should say. And that hypothyroidism means that you should be giving more of the quality of nutrients coming from the ocean, like iodine. Now, hypothyroidism is just the opposite of hyperthyroidism. And hypothyroidism is very common, and it's common in both men and women. It's a malfunctioning thyroid, and it can cause a lot of different illnesses. But I would look at broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, kale, mustard greens, peaches and pears and rutabagas and spinach and turnips. And remember, these all do one thing in common I just mentioned. They suppress thyroid hormone production. So those are the ones that you want to avoid. You also want to avoid dairy products. And also you want to look at iodine and iodine from sea vegetables, because you want to have a natural thyroid replacement, and that is important. So I would go towards sea vegetables. I would get in the hands of a holistic doctor, because there's at least three different therapies that can help you. Unfortunately, I don't have the time, because my guest is standing by, to address this. However, I wrote a definitive article with Dr. Martin Feldman on the subject of thyroids, including the lack of a thyroid. Go to my article page, where I have over 800 articles I've written. This was published in the Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients. Download the article, it's free, and read it. And it will explain everything that you need to have. All right, we're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall, and I was just informed that our guest is in transit, and hopefully we'll make it before the end of the show. If not, we'll reschedule him. And I'm also being told that the books are selling out every line is busy. So if you want to get the new Curing the Incurable cookbook, which is a limited edition, you gotta just be patient and hope that when your call's there, there are books left. Because when there's no more books, our computer says out, and then that's out forever. That number to call again is 862-800-6805. 862-800-6805. Or go to GaryNall.com. Oh, the guest now just arrived, so we'll go over and say hello to my guest. I'm glad that he was able to get with us today. Jerry Ashton, nice to have you with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me to your show.
Jerry, this week the Consumer Bankruptcy Project released a study that 66% of bankruptcies were caused by medical bills, where families were simply unable to afford the bill, or they didn't have the income, they lost their income, maybe they were ill. And the American Journal of Public Health reports that hundreds of millions of households are falling into greater medical debt and face either bankruptcy or being on the street. And on top of that, 75% of all workers are in debt, and about 56% of people live paycheck to paycheck because of the rise in the cost of living. Therefore, there's only one illness that could take them right into ruin. And those are some figures I have, but I'd appreciate you sharing your own statistics that might show the situation of personal medical debt accumulation may be even far worse. The form is yours.
Well, thank you. What we're looking at here is a perfect storm, or maybe even more accurately, a perfect hell in which America's population is falling into. When you mentioned those statistics of 66% of all Americans declared bankruptcy caused in some fashion by medical debt, what it doesn't show is that at least 70% of those people that did declare bankruptcy actually were insured, which means simply that they were not insured enough with our present system. It simply means that whatever was left over in the form of copays and the monies that are extracted from us by the insurance companies called deductibles, where basically we pay all the bills and they collect all of our premiums. You can imagine where we get RIP medical debt, which is a charity that came into existence to abolish the debt that's created by such problems. You can understand that personally we're pretty angry and upset about it, and that's why we not only created this charity but wrote the book that people will need to know about, and that's End Medical Debt. So that's one example of statistics. No matter how you Google it, the average American cannot come up with $500 in spot cash for an emergency. If they can't come up with $500 in spot cash for an emergency, what do you think it means to them month after month to go deeper into debt because they can't afford to fill a prescription? They can't afford the copay. They're embarrassed because they owe the hospital or the physician money. Do you know how many people in Japan declared bankruptcy because of medical debt? None. How many people in Sweden? None. How many people in other countries that have universal health care in some form or another? Almost zero. So we're the only industrial nation of our size that does not take care of its own. The excuse being, of course, that we can't afford it, and the reality being is that we can't afford it. The difference is we can afford it, providing we get out of the illusion that a system in which insurance controls who gets what type of treatment and when and for how much money. Hospitals that are getting larger and larger and charging more and more. I don't have to tell you about Big Pharma and the problem that we're having with them. So it's one of those perfect hells that we've fallen into, and the question is, will we have the guts, the integrity, to be able to find a way out of that? So that's my statement.
Right now you're looking at payday loans, and they're now loosening up the laws that were in place to allow payday loan, I consider them parasites, to make it even easier to entice people in to take out loans that they should never be given because there's no way they can pay them back. So if a person has a medical bill they can't pay, and out of desperation they go to a payday loan, now they could be paying 1,000% interest on top of everything else, and they'll become nothing more than into debt peonage. Your thoughts?
Well, I want to state clearly that I, Jerry Ashton, as a co-author of a book that took three people to write, myself, Craig Antico, and Robert Goff, speaking as individuals, we have very strong opinions about politics that will allow this sort of rapacious approaches to financing any form of need, health care, of course, being the most prevalent one. Payday lenders, the very fact that they, and of course I'm sure that you mean by they, a particular political party has decided that it's okay for a predatory lender to charge that kind of percentage for people who simply want to keep their family alive or put tires on the car or be able to meet the needs of filling a prescription. This is horrible. As a charity, of course, we're sweeping up after the parade. There's $1 trillion worth of medical debt hanging over America. $1 trillion. Every year, $3 trillion worth of medical debt is dispensed. Of that, billions of dollars go into what they call either charity care or uncompensated care, meaning that people did not meet their obligations as self-payers. So this whole merry-go-round, this flight show of what's allowed because legislators allow it. If they wanted it different, they would have it different. But no. So my feeling about any form of abuse of the public is that these people should be publicly flogged and giving everybody an hour to assemble so they can watch. Any questions about that?
Yeah, I would. First of all, Jerry, I would never, ever suggest you flog politicians or police because then you could end up with some form of erotic sadomasochism going on where people become, the victims become so excited they go back and commit another crime to get back in line to get flogged again. You never know what you're opening up.
Unintended
consequences. And the Republic was all sitting around with an erection. In any case, that leads to another question. If we're ever going to have change to reform our healthcare system, how does America's per capita medical debt compare to that in other developed nations who have more of a socialized or universal medical system?
Well, I don't have the exact stats in front of me, but they're easy enough to find. We pay more per capita for the cost of healthcare than any other industrial nation, period. So it's the cost of the services on top of everything else. You don't find those costs in so-called socialized countries because they're not insane enough to allow either the politicians to get away with it, to allow the drug industry to charge the prices that they do. They control that. They control it for the good of the country. It's called the common good. Now, I've never noticed any of these places where the pharmacy went bankrupt because they had to charge a reasonable price. Well, that's my take on things.
Let me give you my own insight in this because I've been studying this for some time and traveling to Sweden, which I have, and other countries. When I speak with the average person, what do you think of your healthcare system? They give you a thumbs up. Now, some of them are overextended, like in England and even in France. But then I look at the quality of the outcome. Are they living longer? Are they able to prevent disease? Like in France, they have a lot of education on the quality of food that a child has in their system. Even if you compared an Italian lunch in schools, a French lunch in schools, a Japanese lunch in schools, and an American lunch, it's night and day. Ours is the worst, theirs is the best. So they know that over-vaccination, they know that a poor diet contributes to a foundation within the biochemical genome that makes them more vulnerable to environmental toxicants like mercury or like aluminum, etc. Yes. So that's one issue. They're into prevention. We're not. If you prevent a disease by your lifestyle, like in Denmark, Denmark now for the last 3 years has registered as the happiest country in the world. They're also one of the healthiest countries in the world. Now, they have a form of socialized medicine. But let's be clear about it, because a lot of the people advocating socialized medicine in the United States are simply not fully aware of how it gets there. They have decided collectively as a group in many of these countries, including Sweden and in Denmark, that they want a free education, they want free medical care, they want 4 weeks to 5 weeks paid vacation, they want a year maternity leave, and someone has to pay for this. So they've accepted that they're going to pay high taxes, 60 to 70% taxes. And because they see where the tax money is going, what you do not see in these countries, you don't see it in Norway, you don't see it in Sweden, Switzerland, Finland, you don't see money going into a military-industrial complex, a medical-industrial complex. And because we're spending over $1 trillion a year above and below line out of the military-industrial complex, we then say we don't have money for Medicare and Medicaid. And then we say, but let's take the richest Americans and give them a tax break, and we bring their taxes way down, their corporate taxes way down to 21%. Well, they weren't paying 21% to begin with. Like Netflix made $700 million this year in profits and paid zero taxes. In fact, we discovered that the 10 of the largest corporations in America making the most profit paid zero taxes, whereas if we had a universal tax that you could not hide it, you couldn't offset it, you simply paid a 20% tax. Every corporation, big or small, no accountants, no IRS, and took away all taxes on a person's personal income. So we shouldn't be taxing our income. We should have elevated, escalating sales taxes. If something is a basic essential for life, like food and water, gasoline, then those should be very low taxes, so it does not strain the American taxpayer. And then if you start getting into luxury items, and the more the luxury item costs, the more it should be taxed on an escalating scale. Now, if everyone paid their actual taxes, then we would not have a deficit. But we want to have it both ways. We want to have the rich pay no taxes, which they generally don't, or minimal, and their corporations pay very little. And then we look at another country, and they're not afraid to pay these taxes, and they know where their money's going, and they're getting value for their dollar. That's what I want to share with you.
Well, you know, when you use the word we, you and I are not included in that we. You and I and other people that we would like to imagine are more aware that we did not sign on to the idea of giving a tax break to the people that don't need it. We're not the ones who did that. It was the politicians, in which case you simply follow the money and you find out which lobbyists are supporting which senators or representatives, and you get a pretty good idea of who's in charge of where money goes and where it doesn't. We are enthralled. We're enthralled to these people. Until and when there'll be enough progressives on both parties, enough far-seeing people, enough statesmen as compared to politicians, when we finally get to that tipping point, there will be a very dramatic shift in how wealth is taxed. That's my personal feeling. Now, if you go back to why we wrote the book, In Medical Debt, we know that basically as a charity, forgiving medical debt, we're sweeping up after the parade. All these terrible stories that we come across every day when people write our website, ripmedicaldebt.org, and say, please help me, and they outline what has happened to them and their families, it's enough to melt the heart of a stone statue. I cannot imagine any politician voting in favor of taking health care away from people or ensuring that they don't get it who would be able to read these letters and meet these people and do that. I cannot imagine what kind of a soul they must have. Now, I wanted to know, give you an idea of the life cycle of a medical debt so you'll see where things fit. First of all, as you pointed out earlier, we are one accident or one sickness away from financial ruin. Something like 15 million Americans live from paycheck to paycheck where they'll be tipped over the line by just one accident, one illness. Now, when that happens, when they go to the hospital and they run up those bills, the hospital is required, it has a fiduciary capacity of chasing those dollars. They also, if they're publicly supported, tax supported, they're also required to give a certain amount of charity help. Well, interestingly enough, because of the ACA, there's less and less charity that's needed because there are fewer and fewer people in comparison that are uninsured. Now, when these people who are underinsured or uninsured slip through the cracks, because a lot of hospitals cannot really determine at a decent rate for various reasons, some of them beyond their control, to identify somebody walking through the door immediately as a charity case, a lot of people end up being sent out to collections. What happens is the hospital will attempt to collect its money. It's ignored for whatever reason. It then sends accounts to collection agencies, which starts the process of chasing down the errant debtor. It might go through two or three collection agencies. Now, these agencies themselves, because they're in business to make a profit, will probably determine that this person can't afford it and they can't squeeze any money out of it. But that doesn't mean they don't put a credit mark against them. It doesn't mean that they don't send out an occasional letter. But at some point in time, they'll send that account out to a debt buyer. Now, only about a third of all America's hospitals will sell their medical debt. But the way that it works is that a debt buyer, funded by Wall Street, funded by banks, will go to a hospital and say, I see you have $100 million worth of uncollected debt there. I just happen to have $5 million loose change in my pocket. Why don't we trade? And then they go to the process where the CFO of that hospital is able to bring in $5 million real dollars to work with, and $100 million worth of non-performing assets goes out the door. But when it goes out the door and it goes in, gets in the hands of the collector, when they collect on that money, it's not for the nickel on the dollar they pay for it. It's for 100 pennies plus interest, plus penalties, and everything else they can put on top of it. Does that give you an idea of the industry, the lifestyle?
Yes, it does. To date, how much medical debt have you and your colleagues raised? And since this is based on donations, explain, please, how you've managed to enable every $100 to forgive up to $10,000 in medical debt. And does your system work to forgive debt?
Yes, it does. As a 501c3, we are allowed, because we have no personal interest in the charity that we give. Our job is to give charity. So when we go to the same debt market that a collection agency would go to, and we would say to the debt seller, okay, you've got $100 million for the debt there. I've got $1 million. I'll give you $1 million for that $100 million. And our money is as good as the collection agency's money, but we say to the debt seller a few more things. Number one, we don't want to buy all of your debt. We only want to buy the debt for people who truly need the charity. And these we identify.
He would do the same thing that a Wall Street group would do, where Wall Street would give $5 million, let's say hypothetically, to buy $100 million worth of debt and then try to collect $100 million plus with penalties and other charges that are allowed by law. Shame on our legislators for not correcting that. He would go and give $1 million, but then forgive that debt completely from those people, and so their credit would not be adversely affected, and they would be notified that your debt has been paid. You have no more debt. That's an extraordinarily noble thing to do. And considering how many, I don't know, I'm guessing hundreds of millions of dollars in debt that they've collected and gotten. Oh, Jerry, I would say that they're probably, how many hundreds of millions of dollars in debt have you been able to forgive from people who couldn't pay?
We have. Our goal when we first started in 2014 was to abolish $1 billion worth of medical debt. As of January of 2019, we have abolished over $500 million, so we're halfway there.
That's terrific. But you see, you're doing what the government should do. If those legislators weren't constantly lobbied by the medical industrial complex, big pharma, the hospital associations, the insurance associations who profit from having people spend money they don't have to begin with, then this wouldn't exist. We're not getting at the cause of the problem, but what you're all doing is one very, very noble gesture towards helping those at the worst end of being victimized. And I thank you very much, well, Jerry, for coming on today.
It's my pleasure, and thanks so much for inviting me.
I just want one last thing from you. Here is one of our fundamental problems and challenges. Today, health is an industry. It's not a service to serve the public good and improve its physical, mental, and financial well-being. And we no longer practice ethical medicine today in general. There are certainly specific physicians who do, but the majority don't, which was dedicated to treating patients historically. Rather, we are in the business of disease management. If patients has to be on a diabetes or cardiovascular drug for the remainder of their lives, that is preferable to being fully cured. There's no financial incentive and profit to make shareholders happy if a drug is found to actually cure once and for all and heal people of a disease and do it rapidly. Therefore, reaching health should be our goal, not simply generating revenues to pay for the health care system that far exceeds the cost per capita of any other developed nation. Your final thoughts?
You said it all. The truth is, and I'm a businessman. I have been for years. I was a bill collector for many years. I knew how to make a dollar, and I knew that I had to pay taxes for those dollars I made. But in all cases, my ethics ran the business. If I were collecting an account that I understood and learned to be insolvent or in some form of hardship, I would go back to my client and patiently explain to them that they should, as a matter of honor and integrity, let it go, bless it, and release it. So if we had a medical system where the doctor didn't have to worry about being paid, where the hospitals didn't have to worry about allotting so much for profit and therefore restrict services, if we had a pharmacy that was there dedicated to curing people rather than filling the bottom the pockets of their investors, we would have a much different picture that we would be looking at.
I agree. Jerry Ashton, thank you very much for all the good work you and your associates are doing.
Thank you so much.
And he is the author of In Medical Debt, Curing America's $1 Trillion Unpayable Medical Debt. His website is ripmedicaldebt.org. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program.
Hit it. How? How you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?